Community Conversations with Community Centres SA. Here's Kerry Ackermans.
Today on the podcast, we'll be talking about a very important topic, and that's medical research. We'll be speaking to the team at SAMRE, South Australian Health and Medical Research Institute, one of their professors, Tim Hughes, and a member of his clinical trial, Janet Anderson. First off, though, I'll be speaking to Maria Macrides, who is the Executive Director of SAMRE. Maria, tell us about SAMRE as an organisation, the South Australian Health and Medical Research Institute. People often think it's government funding, but that's not true, is it?
No, SAMRE is a standalone, research-only institution. We have a relatively independent governance, so we're completely reliant mainly on our researchers writing grants to undertake the work. We do get a small amount of funding from government, but it doesn't actually help us cover the full cost of research. So philanthropy and other sources of funding become really important to allow our researchers to be able to flourish.
And everyone affectionately knows it as the Pineapple Building on North Terrace, but it is so much more, of course. Maria, is there a type of research that SAMRE focuses on specifically?
We have four main areas of research. We have our Aboriginal Health Equity Team is probably the largest concentration of researchers in Aboriginal health in the country, and their work is mainly focused on prevention and treatment and new therapies for chronic disease. Our SAMRE Women and Kids team is very much focused on nutritional and lifestyle interventions to improve the outcomes of women and their children. And our lifelong health theme has a strong focus on pain, chronic pain, and finding out ways to reduce chronic pain, prevention of cardiovascular disease, and looking at other ways that we can improve healthy aging. Today, you'll hear from people in our precision cancer theme, and they really amongst the world leaders in treatment for blood cancers.
Marie, all of those are things that have hit for many people, particularly cancer, that they would resonate with that. So if you get your money through the research grants, how else can you be supported? Can the community donate money to SAMRE?
Sure, the community can donate money to SAMRE, and that is actually really important for supplementing our researchers. A lot of the research grant funding that we get doesn't cover the full cost of research, so that money becomes very important to those areas. And also, if we've followed a certain path and the data doesn't quite stack up and you need to go in a slightly different direction, the money that we can get from community or philanthropy allows us to get those new ideas before we can go to government and get the big grants.
And people are able to go and do a tour of the facility. I've done one myself and it's amazing. How do they get to do that, Maria?
You can book on our website, which is probably the easiest way to do that.
I'm talking to Maria Macrides, Executive Director of SAMRE. Maria, what would you say to the public is the importance of their support and understanding about what SAMRE does?
The importance of public support is there in multiple ways. The engagement with some of our clinical trials, one of the reasons we've been able to do so much in a relatively short time is because our community participates in research, and that's actually a really important thing. If people can't participate in research or want to volunteer in other ways, a donation is hugely welcome. But volunteering their time, participating in research, donations, they're all ways that become really important in collectively improving the health of our community.
And they can even walk. You've just had your Bright Walk event.
We have had our Bright Walk, which is our annual awareness raising and fundraising event. We've had about 1,300 people participate in that, and it was just a glorious Saturday afternoon.
And I believe you can also buy a window.
Indeed, you can buy a window, and many people have chosen to do that as a memorial gift for people who have died, passed away. A lovely way to remember someone's legacy.
Well, Maria, really appreciate that background. We're talking to Maria Macrides, Executive Director of SAMRE. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
About to have a conversation with Professor Tim Hughes, who works with SAMRE, who's worked with a common leukemia over the past 3 decades, which has turned from a fatal disease with a 5-year life expectancy to a chronic condition that can be readily managed with medication, and increasingly seeing patients stop their medication and remain in remission. We'll be speaking to Jenna Anderson, one of the members of Tim's clinical trials, shortly. Tim, welcome to the podcast. This Thanks. Research is absolutely vital. Walk us through what the research is about. What you've been working on.
Well, when I first started treating chronic myeloid leukemia in the 90s, it was pretty much, yes, a fatal disease. We could keep people alive for 3 or 4 years, but it would eventually become an untreatable leukemia and they would pass away. In about 2000, we had a new type of therapy called a kinase inhibitor therapy, and that transformed the field so that rather than patients dying within 3 or 4 years, we were keeping them in some level of remission for many years, but the downside was that they needed their drug every day, probably for the rest of their life, to keep that leukemia at bay. And the day-to-day side effects of these drugs are quite significant, so their quality of life was quite impaired. And it became a struggle, but most patients were up for that struggle because it kept them alive. But over the last almost 10 years, we've been developing a new type of kinase inhibitor that's much better targeted to the leukemia. This drug was developed by Novartis, and we've worked alongside Novartis to get this drug into clinical trials. We were the first site in the world to use this drug in patients who'd already failed several other drugs, and it looked very promising. So we put a proposal to Novartis about 5 years ago that we should try using this drug right up front for patients with CML, because it was a potent drug, but it didn't have all those side effects that we were struggling with the other drugs. So we started this frontline study, and Janet, who we'll be hearing from, was one of our very first patients on that study. We started about 3 years ago, and the results were remarkable. Because this drug is very potent, we were getting much higher rates of good remission, to the point where we're quite hopeful that over the next 3 to 4 years, we'll be able to actually stop therapy for many of these patients, because we've learned over the last decade that if we can achieve a deep response and maintain that response for a couple of years, a lot of patients, the majority, can actually stop and remain in remission, which is the ultimate aim of our therapy.
That's remarkable, Professor, when you think about all of that, what happened previously and where you've come to today. So when you look at when COVID came in, the world collaborated like they never had before and brought vaccines. What sort of collaboration is there for the work that you're doing? Do you put it out so people know you're working on this and people aren't tripping over each other doing the same research?
Yeah, we communicate all the time. I mean, we have meetings. We have a critical meeting once a year where virtually all of the doctors that have a focus on chronic myeloid leukemia come together, present their most recent results. We share those results. There's still competition, of course, but there's also very good collaboration. So, for instance, when we started doing this frontline study, we presented those results within the first 12 months. There was a lot of excitement. And then several other countries have started their own studies. And in fact, we're involved in a multinational study, which I actually just presented in Chicago, which is comparing this new drug called asciminib to the best available therapy that we had before, showing that it's significantly better. So these things move quite fast if you can get that collaboration. And the key to that is good communication.
Of course. And clinical trials are very important. Is it difficult to get people into trials, and how do you get into them?
The hard thing with clinical trials, it's not so hard to get a good idea. The hard thing is to get it funded. So it's not so bad if there's a pharma company that thinks this is a great idea. But if you're trying to repurpose a drug that's no longer at a patent, it's incredibly hard. Once you've got that study funded and running, it's not a great challenge to get patients interested, because the vast majority of patients that I talk to and I say, look, we've got this new trial. I can't tell you whether it's going to be a benefit to you, but we're going to learn a lot. There's almost no hesitation to say, oh, I'm in, because they recognize that this is how they've been able to access really good treatment. And the only way forward is to get better and better trials that can test better strategies.
And how does the patient get into this trial? They're referred by GPs or by specialists?
If you're a patient with chronic myeloid leukemia, you'll be under the care of a hematologist. And all of the hematologists around Adelaide and virtually around Australia know about the key centres that will run clinical trials. So they have a patient that they think might be suitable. The vast majority of them will be very happy to tell that patient that we're going to get you to see one of those doctors at one of those centres to run in that trial. Maybe at the end of the trial, they'll go back to their care. But generally, there's a very good spirit of collaboration in that way.
And we think that if somebody was on a clinical trial, they'd do everything they can. I'm talking to Professor Tim Hughes, who's a researcher at SAMRE. But are there some people who perhaps undertake less than appropriate health activities, if we just say they still smoke, or like are there conditions if you're in and if you do that, then you're out?
Yeah, that, I mean, it's a challenge for all of our patients. The fact that many of these drugs that we use actually do increase your risk of heart attack and stroke. And of course, that's a real worry when you're on a drug for the next 20, 30, 40 years. Mm. So smoking is something that we very strongly counsel against. And I'd say 95, 98% of the patients either don't smoke or give up smoking. But all the other sort of important health things are critically important as well. The right diet, the right physical activity. You'll hear from Janet how she's taken that to heart. But, you know, the patients who do best are those patients who are motivated and look at the other aspects of their life and try and optimize those factors as well. For clinical trials, we definitely do focus on patients that have to consent to the trial, have to consent to all of the assessments. So that will rule out some patients who are not that interested in that level of discipline.
Of course. Now, interestingly, when you hear about research and about coming up with new drugs and treatments for fatal diseases or any disease, there's often that theory, particularly around cancer, that, oh, the pharmaceutical companies have the cure for cancer, but they won't release it. Tell us about that myth.
Well, I've heard that. And of course, it's completely ridiculous. I mean, the vast majority of pharma companies, if they develop a drug they think might have some small advantage, will come to us very, very early on and give us some of that drug to use in the laboratory to test it out and talk to us in sort of advisory board settings to how we can best design a trial to get this drug out there. It frustrates me. It's like the whole thing about immunizations being a big plot. I mean, it's crazy.
They're putting a chip in everybody. Yes, I have heard that one too. So, Professor, if you had a wand, what would you wish for in terms of research?
Well, I think if we could just have a great idea and put that into a clinical trial without having to spend 1 or 2 years, it's almost like when you have a movie idea, you've got to find
a backer, the money.
Backer, and that's exactly what to do with a clinical trial. Now, you can get money through the government funding if you have a really good idea, but it's so competitive. So if it was possible, if you had a great idea, to get that into a clinical trial in a relatively short period and answer that question, I think we'd be making much better progress much more rapidly.
And Maria was telling me that all of the researchers have to write their own grants because you have your own specific knowledge.
That's right.
So what wins the money? Is it the prevalence of the disease? Is it the percentage chance of its success rate? What makes it possible to get that research money?
Generally, research money is awarded according to the excellence of the candidate. So almost half the assessment process is how well have they used money in the past? How many really original, important ideas have they developed into actual having an impact in the clinic? You know, that's what people are judged on, as well as how well they design the, whether it's a research project or a clinical trial. In either case, it's very much scored on the basis of excellence of scientific approach. And it's highly competitive. I mean, a lot of these government-funded research, it's like a 10 or 20% success rate. So you can see that you're writing a lot of grants to get that one or two that get the critical funding you need.
And do you think that we'll also start looking at preventive as well, or being able to diagnose earlier? Because it still astounds me that someone who seems fine goes to the doctor and say, you better get your affairs in order. I'm sorry to tell you, but you have this level of stage 4 of cancer, or whatever it might be, or leukemia. Yeah. And you think, how on earth have you functioned?
Yeah. Look, I mean, prevention and early diagnosis are incredibly important for a lot of the solid cancers, not so much in the blood cancer field. Generally, you don't gain a lot by diagnosing a leukemia a month or two earlier. It's already widely disseminated in the body. Doesn't mean you can't cure it, but it's not a matter of catching it before it spreads, because the nature of a blood cancer is it's already spread. So early diagnosis is not a huge issue for us as hematologists, and prevention has got very limited approach because there's not much evidence, except for the evidence that if you're exposed to a nuclear explosion, that you'll have a high risk of leukemia. Otherwise...
Oh, and many other problems.
Yeah, and if you survive the explosion. But otherwise, there's not a lot you can do to prevent leukemia. It's going to be around with us for the next 1,000 years because it's intrinsic to the way our bone marrow works, that you're going to get genetic errors coming up from time to time that are going to lead to leukemia. So we're not going to stamp it out by some clever preventative strategy. We're going to need to be very clever at treating it in the most non-toxic way possible.
Would it be able to test to see if you have a genetic marker for it and therefore you might go to the doctor more or look for signs?
That's a great issue. That's certainly, as we know, very much the case with the breast cancer, ovarian cancer with BRCA1, BRCA2. I think we're going to get more of those sort of genes that'll be recognised as a risk for blood cancers as well, but not to that same sort of level of risk. But that will probably come into the formula as well. That's a very important area of investigation.
Well, it's an incredibly important thing that you're doing, Professor, and I really appreciate the time you've given today. Our community centres see everyone from all walks of life, and nearly everyone knows somebody who is unfortunately suffering from a form of cancer or leukaemia.
Thanks very much for your time.
Just been joined by Janet Anderson, who is a member of Professor Tim Hughes' clinical trials that we've just been speaking to. Janet, thank you for joining us. This is a very brave thing to do, but I was amazed when you came in to see you had all your gorgeous bright orange, including a bright orange violin case.
Yes, I do love bright colours and I love playing the violin and are lucky enough to be a member of the Adelaide Symphony Orchestra.
And you're off to perform for what tonight?
We're accompanying the Australian Ballet, so that's one of the wonderful things we get to do.
That's all of the jewels. Well, look, that's very exciting. So what a full and rich life and what a talented person. So, Janet, you became a member of this trial. Just walk us back from that for what you're comfortable to share of the diagnosis and the journey you're on in this trial opportunity.
Yeah, sure. Well, this came about at the end of 2020, everybody's favourite year. And I didn't actually realise how tired and sick my body was because, like everybody else, that was a very confusing year. Everybody was very tired by the end. And so when this diagnosis came through in November, I was absolutely floored. Came out of, you know, seemingly nowhere. In hindsight, I had been quite fatigued. My regular runs had been very difficult and I was trying to work out why. But yes, from the shock diagnosis, I was led through the possible treatment opportunities and it became clear that coming onto this clinical trial was going to be the best option for me.
And it's very fortunate to get into those clinical trials. It's not easy. What did you think would happen at the end of it? What sort of were there, I guess there's no guarantees, and the risks involved? How did they prepare you for it?
Well, I think it was interesting to talk through the drugs that are available versus coming onto this trial drug. And I think because there are non-side effects associated with the other three drugs that are available for CML, that it, you know, because this new drug is so much more targeted to the leukemia cells that the chances of having side effects were minimised, and I was really keen to try that.
Absolutely, because it's like that lifeline. Was it hard to have the time in between when you were taking the drug and then them doing the test? Because I presume you have regular testing to see if it's working.
Yes, but it was amazing. I mean, to keep me in the chronic phase straight after being diagnosed, I took an oral chemotherapy drug for 3 weeks, at which point I was extremely fatigued and felt dreadful. And then once I commenced this trial drug, I immediately, within a few days, started improving, feeling better. And each test that was taken showed that my levels were getting lower and lower and lower. And within 6 months, my levels of this leukemia were undetectable and they've remained there. So,
and you're feeling better, not fatigued now?
Definitely, yes. Yes. So, within 6 months, I was feeling much better. And within a year after being diagnosed, I wanted to make sure that my body was still working. So I put my name down for a mini triathlon just to make sure that I could still push my body hard.
Absolutely. Of which you're doing that as a fundraiser, which we'll talk about before we finish. Janet, how was your mental state through all of this? And were you offered any mental support through this, mental health support?
I don't specifically remember being offered it. I think obviously there are services there if I was looking for it. My sort of darkest time was obviously at the initial diagnosis, at which point you hear the words leukemia.
No one wants to hear.
And, you know, I've got two young children. First thought is, oh my goodness, I'm not going to get to see them grow up. You know, the worst possible thought for a mother. And so those first couple of weeks were extremely dark and extremely scary. But once commencing this trial drug and being able to see the CML team at SAMRI, I've only felt better and been able to look forward and hopeful for the future. So, yeah, I'm extremely grateful to everybody part of this trial.
And I'm sure your family is as well. It must have been a relief for them. How did you get to enter this trial? Did your doctor refer you in?
I was able to talk to the head haematologist at the RA, Dr. David Jung, and he spoke to me and talked me through my options, and it just became clear that this was going to be by far the best option for me. As a musician, as a young person, I was told, you know, mostly it is men over 60 who are the majority of people that are diagnosed with CML. So to be a 37-year-old female, you know, that's quite rare, and I've got my whole life ahead of me. I want to be packing in exciting, fulfilling things into every day. And so grateful that I'm able to do that on this drug.
I'm talking to Janet Anderson, who is part of Professor Tim Hughes' clinical trials about a new medication for leukemia. It's been very successful. Janet, how are you feeling now that you're standing where you are and looking back? Has it made you think differently about life?
I've always been a very positive, optimistic person that hasn't ever taken anything for granted, but this definitely hammered home the fact that you're not in control and anything can happen at any time. So extra grateful for when I'm feeling well, because I'd never felt so sort of sick and in a dark place as at that initial diagnosis time. So appreciation for feeling well, your body being healthy, being able to spend time with family and friends, and being able to work in such a fulfilling job as the ASO. Yeah.
And you're just so full of beautiful energy, Jenna, and you're obviously very talented. Now, you yourself are going to engage in some fundraising for research. Tell us about that.
I am indeed. I mean, I will honestly do anything I possibly can for this research team, and forever will be indebted to the CML research at SAMRI. And I thought, well, what can I do? I'm coming near the end of this trial period. I'm going to put my name down for a full triathlon. So on the 3rd of November, I will be doing a 1.5 ocean swim and a 40-kilometre bike ride and a 10-kilometre run in Noosa.
How amazing. Now, the only thing that would make that very difference is if you were playing the violin at the same time.
That would be even more of a challenge.
Well, I did hear someone saying that they saw someone doing a triathlon in a dinosaur suit, and I think playing a violin is even harder. I think you could trump that and get more money, Jenna.
Right. Okay. Well, I'll take that on board.
Store that in. Well, Jenna, your story is amazing. I'm just so grateful. You're really happy to share that, and it does warm my heart. And as you said, the SAMRI team, how incredible, but look at the results.
Yes, it is amazing. Yeah, I'm so privileged to be a part of this trial.
So get along and see the ballet, and you will hear Janet Anderson playing the violin back in there, but also support her fundraiser. How do we find out about it?
That's on the SAMRI website in the fundraising section. You'll see me and the Noosa Beach in the background.
Sounds beautiful. Thank you for joining us on the podcast today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And thank you for listening and engaging with our community conversations today. Every week, we aim to bring you stories from far and wide, across South Australia and beyond. People who are game changers in our community, doing great work, plus general topics of community interest. If you have any subjects you think we should cover or any other feedback, please let us know at communitycentressa.asn.au. And feel free to share this podcast so we can engage more people in our next community conversation.
Community Conversations. For more information, check out communitycentressa.asn.au.